that's no good. More boulders. Zooming along, he chose yet another. That was no good either. At last he saw a decent spot. With only 90 seconds of fuel left, 20 of which he needed for an abort, he headed for it just 100 feet off the surface. As he began at last to settle to a touchdown, Eagle's rocket engines started blowing the lunar dust around, putting him in a grayout. Armstrong let the visual cues drop away without wavering on the controls. Now it was all vestibular and proprioception, literally seat of the pants, as he gentled Eagle to the ground. He even had the presence of mind to assess his own behavior, as many elite performers do in the clinch. As Chaikin recounts, he was displeased with himself, sure that he was not flying Eagle smoothly. He had 20 seconds worth of fuel left when he shut the engine down, precisely the amount he needed to get home. Leshak's description of his 20 years of risking his life as a wildland firefighter applies exactly. I'm a secular priest ordained by training, experience, and most important, the willingness to accept the mantle of command. That willingness encompasses the realization that failure is easy, and such failure could kill me, or worse, kill someone else. And, as was true of the pilots in Beaver Flight, it's the nature of our society that I'm considered unworthy of huge financial reward for that risk. But what can be earned is a certain nobility, not in the sense of aristocratic status, but in the sense of striving for quality and dignity of behavior and living. In 1988, Harper's published an article I wrote about flying with the IPs of Beaver Flight, as they humorously called themselves. At the time, I was hot on the quest to enter my father's realm of cool and heroism, and so I had no idea that I was talking about the essentials of survival when I wrote of their humor and their modest cool. I asked Captain Rogers, my instructor, how they selected candidates to be Air Force fighter pilots. Like Croesus pestering Solon, I was perhaps secretly hoping that he'd say that I was the ideal candidate. Instead, he said, "Well, you see, we go down to the Dunkin' Donuts and we take everybody who's sitting at the counter and we say, 'Okay, you're pilots.' Then we send them out to an airfield somewhere, real far away, and we put them in airplanes and see if they can fly." In a more serious frame of mind one day, he told me what makes a good fighter pilot. "He's the kind of person who, when you tell him something, he gets it right away. He's a good athlete. He's competitive. He can stand up in front of 100 people and speak on something he doesn't know about. He'll just do it. He won't hesitate. He's a creature of habit and a perfectionist." The pilots who are selected to fly fighter planes are chosen for their academic performance as well as their flying grades. They're taken from the top 5%, and the grades have to be calculated to 2 decimal places just to establish the rankings, he told me. He was describing my father. He was describing the perfect survivor, too. The image of the fighter pilot, or the astronaut for that matter, that has been created by popular movies and literature, was true in my father's day, but not anymore. In the urgency of war, the entire process was different. And in a way, it was necessary for the Army to enlist the sort of airborne Hell's Angels just to get the job done. My father described the physical exam this way. The doctor said, "Can you see lightning and hear thunder? Congratulations, you're now a pilot." In the midst of the Cold War, when President Kennedy promised to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, the same urgency applied to sending men into space. The archetype described in The Right Stuff was true then, but it's not true now. There were pilots in my father's day who would drink all night and were rumored to put tobacco in their eyes just to keep them open while they flew the next day's mission. One was said to bungee the stick to the window frame and sleep on the way into battle. I can't say for sure if that's true, but knowing the people I've met, it wouldn't surprise me. The astronaut of today is more likely to have a PhD than a drinking problem. The modern fighter pilot does not strut around grabbing fannies. For one thing, some of the pilots are women, and the Navy's experience with grabbing fannies demonstrated what the consequences can be. The Friday night crud games can get violent, and people do get drunk, but that's one night a week. And anybody who drinks much more often finds himself flying a desk. No one buzzes the tower and stays in the Air Force either. I saw some pilots shooting down their watches and slapping high fives on the ramp one day and mistakenly thought they really were like Tom Cruise in Top Gun. As I approached the van for the ride out to the airplane, I heard one of them say, "I feel the need," and another one answer, "The need for speed." Captain Rogers explained to me that they were making fun of the movie. If a pilot here acted like Tom Cruise acted in that movie, he would have no friends. He'd be an outcast. The same arrogance and reckless disregard for safety that will kill you in a high-performance aircraft will kill you in the wilderness or in any other place of high objective hazard. The modern craze for high-risk sports and wilderness recreation, which has been embraced by so many naive travelers, is bound to result in accidents. But the images such myths project make it even more likely. An ad for a Nissan SUV, for example, showed a mountain biker through the open hatchback of the truck. He's injured, his limbs in makeshift traction, and his bike has been destroyed. The headline read, "Recovery Room." The implication is that part of the fun is in getting hurt. But hurting and getting hurt are two different things. A Zen priest I know studied to be an archer. He described his first lesson to me. The master took him to a cliff at dawn. He set up a target and strung his bow. Then he drew an arrow and aimed at the target. With the bow taut, he turned at the last moment and shot the arrow out over the cliff. "We are officers first," Captain Rogers explained, "pilots second. The flying is not the point, just as hitting the target is not the point of the Zen discipline of archery. They are both side effects of a way of life. Side effects of integrity that lead to the way. Once you no longer need or desire to hit the target, then the way leads you there. Being one with the bow, you do not have to hit the target. The bow does it for you. Integrity begins with humility." When I was finishing my training, Captain Rogers received word that he'd been assigned to F-15s, a coveted job. I asked him whether it was because he was the best. "No, no," he laughed, embarrassed by the suggestion. "I was just lucky. Real lucky." I thought his choice of words was telling. Once my father got his airplane shot to pieces and was decorated for saving his crew. Years later, when I asked him how he'd done it, he said, "I was just lucky. Very lucky." And he laughed. 15. The Day of the Fall. That vector leading to survival, which Joe Simpson and Steve Callahan took, stretches back into childhood. To enter the wilderness, to challenge the forces of nature, we must be worthy. And worthiness doesn't come from a weekend survival school, the Eagle Scouts, or even a few years in the military. Peter Leshak wrote, "In fire and other emergency operations, you must not merely tolerate uncertainty, you must savor it, or you won't last long." The most efficient preparation is a general mental, physical, and professional readiness nurtured over years of training and experience. You live to live. Preparing is itself an activity, and action is preparation. He's talking about making himself worthy of survival, and his way of doing it in the wilderness is with the added burden of fire, just as my father's manner of flying, itself an act of survival, was to do it while people were shooting at him. I first learned about being worthy from my father. I learned again when I became a pilot, and again when I became an instrument pilot, a commercial pilot, and then an aerobatics pilot. Flying bush pilot planes in the Arctic regions of Alaska, the Brooks Range, and on up the coast past Wainwright to Barrow, I learned, too, about indifferent forces that punish inattention or arrogance. When I was competing with the International Aerobatics Club, even as I saw those around me being killed, I realized that I had to be at once bold and humble, that I had to open my mind to this energetic world, which never sits still. The complex churning of its materials, from which I'd made my own Braille language of life. My father was too badly injured in his crash to continue as a pilot, and went back to school to become a medical school professor, a scientist. I followed him to the University of Texas, then to Baylor Medical School, and at last to Northwestern, and grew up working in his labs, eventually operating an electron microscope, and peering with him into the very machinery of human cells. I'd go to his classes so that I'd be able to speak his language, the language of science. When he took the podium, he always began by saying, "Fellow students." He taught me the humility of knowing that we were all, always, students, and that to stop being a student was to stop living. When he turned 70 years old, I was hot and heavy on the contest circuit with the International Aerobatics Club. I took him up for his birthday to show him my routine of spins, loops, rolls, hammerheads, Cuban eights, Immelmans, and split S's, a continuous corkscrewing of the airplane which let one maneuver lead into the next in a sort of high-octane gasoline ballet. A plane is a noisy, stinking thing to those on the ground, but to the pilot it can sometimes seem absolutely silent, like a sailboat, until you hear the wrong sound, and then it gets your prompt attention. On that flight, my father sat quietly in the tandem seat as I ripped the plane through 4 and 5 G's, climbing, descending, rolling, and falling through the hard air, switching blue sky for green earth 12 times a minute as the smooth beauty of the whirling world filled me with wonder and joy. It didn't feel as if I flew the plane. It felt as if I'd become the plane. The wingtips had nerves. My brother Michael, one of my father's students and a physician, had expressed some concern that the G-forces might be bad for our father at his age. But when I was done and my wheels barked onto the asphalt, my father climbed out and said, "You're a really good pilot." He did not give praise idly. It was one of the most important moments in my life. I was worthy. Airworthy. When people hear about my father's survival, they think of the long fall from the sky, or the moment when that German peasant standing on the stub of wing pulled the trigger on his old pistol and it misfired. But those singular events are not the point. Sure, it takes luck to be a survivor, and luck is nothing more than the accumulation of circumstance throughout a life. One year, I arrived in Glacier National Park to watch the biggest snow-clearing operation in the United States. The big bend near the apex of Going to the Sun Road can be 100 feet deep in snow, and the road is only 2 lanes wide. Avalanches regularly rip through there, sometimes sweeping men and machines off into the couloirs. As the weather warms, the cliffs calve rocks the size of automobiles. As I settled in with the crew, the snow boss told me that the previous season, on the day the road opened, a 30-ton rock had fallen onto a car, killing a Japanese tourist while sparing his wife in the passenger seat next to him. And I thought, all his life he drove along roads to get to that exact spot at that exact moment. And so did his wife, who survived. But her survival didn't end at that moment, it began there. Her task was to survive the terrible event, to go on, and live her life. So with my father. The lesson of survival that I took from his story was not that he was so lucky as to fall 27,000 feet and not die. It was that he had to have the strength to go on and live 60 more years after losing his beloved brothers, his crew, after breaking his body into so many pieces, after prison camp. He was 23 years old and had to forge a strategy for surviving everything else. I'd seen many of his fellow combatants simply give up, collapsed old men, walking ghosts. That the German peasant's old and badly abused pistol jammed was sheer chance. Everything after that was not. As he lay there in a heap by the rudder pedals, my father watched his would-be assassin with a sort of dim, swooning amusement as the man tried to get the firing mechanism sorted out. Then my father began laughing, which infuriated the German, who was cursing a blue streak. My father was able to understand German reasonably well and was struck by the movie-like quality of the scene. It was all a bit much to get blown out of the sky and fall 27,000 feet without a parachute and survive, only to land in the exact spot where there's a pissed-off farmer with a gun. He couldn't stop laughing. It was the beginning of his salvation, not the end. Humor was the key. A German officer appeared and told the farmer that he could not shoot the American pilot, who was officially a prisoner of the German Reich. There was an argument, harsh words. The peasant said that the pilot deserved to die for bombing them, and anyway, he wasn't going to live long. Look at him. Indeed, his nose had been cut off, he was bleeding profusely, and he was crumpled in a bloody, mangled heap. He was obviously delirious. Look, he's laughing. While they were arguing about his fate, Mrs. Pfeiffer came out from her farmhouse outside the town of Neuss, now a suburb of Düsseldorf. The front half of the B-17 had come down on the side of a railroad embankment that bordered her land, and she was hopping mad. The aft portion of the plane had crashed about half a mile away with some of the crew, one of whom had lost his legs somewhere in the sky. She'd seen the whole thing from her house. For some time now she had refused to take shelter against the air raids. The German soldiers were all young, and the woman took advantage of her age, ordering them to care for the wounded pilot. My father awoke in the snow, laid out with some of his dead crew. I was in and out of consciousness, he told me, but I was deliriously happy. Maybe it was because of my injuries. Maybe someone had given me morphine, I don't know. But I felt no pain, and I was just happy to be alive. But to his left was Colonel Hunter, his commandant and co-pilot for the day. My father was captain of the ship, and as such he was responsible for the safety of all on board. Now Hunter lay dead in the newly fallen snow, and the lieutenant couldn't help feeling guilty about how happy he was to be alive when all the rest were dead. While he struggled with the confusing emotions, he began vomiting blood. He concluded that he must have internal injuries. Suddenly his joy turned to terror as he realized that he was going to die. After all that, to perish in the snow. He began crying, and a German soldier, himself no more than a boy, came over to see what the trouble was. He reached down and flipped the American boy's nose back into place for him. Although it had been cut off by flying glass or metal, it had been hanging by a flap of skin. And now my father understood. He'd been lying on his back, swallowing all the blood from his flesh wound. That's why he was throwing up. Once more, he was overcome with joy. He was going to live. He passed out again. Mrs. Pfeiffer ordered the German soldiers to carry the wounded American lieutenant into her house, and when he awoke the next time, they had laid him before her fireplace. She gave him tea and a cigarette. As both his arms, both hands, both feet, both legs, and numerous ribs were broken, she had to hold the tea and help him smoke a cigarette, and he thought, this isn't going to be so bad. Maybe this is what German prison camp is like, tea and cigarettes before a cozy fire. Then a truck was pulled up to the house, and he was thrown into the back of it and driven overland. As soon as we started bouncing across that frozen ground, he said, I could feel the broken bones grinding against each other. The pain was so excruciating that he couldn't stop screaming until he mercifully passed out once more. But each time he came to, he awoke screaming. At last they arrived at the prison camp near Gerresheim, where he was thrown in a basement with prisoners from all over Europe and America. By chance, one of them, Dr. Gehry, was a member of the French Resistance. He was a surgeon and had been allowed some meager medical supplies with which to treat the wounded. There were also a few male nurses who were allowed to work in the crude lazaret. Dr. Gehry wired my father up with piano wire and plastered him all over until he looked like a great albino spider hanging from the basement ceiling beneath a single bare globe, which was strung on a length of electric cord. In the ensuing days and weeks, Dr. Gehry would have to tighten the wires to tune the piano, and my father would scream as he had not screamed since the truck ride from the crash site to the cellar. When he begged for morphine, Dr. Gehry told him, "Is that the way the babies scream when you bomb them? Morphine is for heroes, not for American flyers who bomb babies." Then he'd turn a wire tighter, and my father would scream louder. Dr. Gary was a pacifist. So strange, thought my father, to be tortured by the Allies, not the enemy. He had to love and hate Dr. Gary. The 8th Air Force continued to stage its bombing raids on the area, and when the bombers rumbled overhead, the light globe above my father's bed would start swinging as the 500-pounders detonated around the camp. He'd watch the light bulb and listen to his piano wires play a bizarre and dissonant tune like Bartok, a prelude, it seemed, to a direct hit that would blow them all to bits. If the bombs were close enough, the light would swing so hard that it would shatter against the ceiling and shower him with broken glass. By the time spring came to the German farm fields, my father's bones had knitted, and one of the very muscular male nurses, a French prisoner named Henri Morieux, would carry him upstairs like a baby and set him in the sun beneath a blanket. One day in April, he was sitting in his chair in the sun, the blanket over his knees. It was a perfect day, with just a few high clouds. A front had come through and cleared away the smells of war which sometimes hung over them. The sun was warm, and the air was cool. My father was left alone with the guards, who were scattered about some distance away. He watched the far hills, daydreaming and almost dozing off. Most of the dreams were about food. The German guards ate potatoes, which was all that was left in the war-torn countryside, and they gave the potato peelings to the prisoners to make a thin soup. Slowly starving, my father found that he had become obsessed with mayonnaise, which he loves to this day. At other times, he'd daydream about his mother, Rosa, who grew roses and painted and made pottery, or the girl back home, his fiancée and eventually my mother, Anna Marie Mosher, whose grandfather was a railroad worker and had been run over by his own train on his 60th birthday. My father would remember his old dog, whose name was G.I., and his father, Agustin, coming home to Rosa after work, where he made barbecue in a stone pit over a mesquite wood fire and sold it to the workers in the area. Agustin would sweep the front porch and steps in the afternoon light, and then continue sweeping down the sidewalk to the dirt street in the barrio where they lived, sweeping and sweeping between the rows of Rosa's roses. My father could hear the soft snap of playing cards to his left, where two guards were engaged in a game. To his right, some others were just standing, staring into space, and two more were sharing a cigarette. The hills were turning green. He felt calm, almost happy, and quite distant from the incessant pain of an empty stomach and knitting bones. Something caught his eye on the top of the farthest hill. He saw something move. As he watched, a figure seemed to grow out of the hill, a man under a burden, walking, coming from the far side, now cresting the hill, now advancing over its near side. The figure was still too far away for my father to tell anything about it, but even at that distance, something about it struck my father as odd. Nothing ever came over those hills, and there was just something familiar in the movement. Impossible. He was too far away to distinguish any details, except that the man labored under a large pack and other gear. But my father was idle, dozing, and he had nothing to do other than watch as the figure came on and on. He didn't know how long he watched the figure grow out of the new green landscape. It fell into a depression between two hills and vanished for a while. Then it reappeared over the next rise, larger, more distinct. And my father knew that there was definitely something about it. He sat forward in his chair. Something about the man's burden that my father just couldn't put his finger on. He wondered if he was hallucinating from starvation. Then the guards noticed, too. The card game stopped, and the others stood at the ready. A soldier ground out a cigarette with the toe of his boot and blew a thin stream of blue smoke into the windless air. His hand came up to shade his eyes as he watched. They formed a still tableau as the lone figure advanced across the hills, coming now through an open field of yellow flowers, perhaps an eighth of a mile wide. He was dressed in green-gray, that much was now clear, and he was armed. The top of his head was round, and suddenly my father could see why. He wore a helmet. The field of yellow blossoms seemed so enormous and bright, as if the figure floated on a bowl of liquid sun. The guards drew together into a group and placed their Schmeissers at the ready. Everyone was fixed so intently on that lone figure, that personage arriving, taking so long to arrive, and the accumulation of detail and meaning as he grew larger, and the vast landscape around him, and the yellow field of flowers that seemed alternately to swallow and offer him up as if he floated on an ocean wave. He might be an ant for all his mass, and yet how he commanded their attention, as if they were the members of a primitive cult awaiting at long last the returning god of their mythology. Perhaps those boys knew long before my father did what they were looking at. The man was only 200 yards off when the injured flyer began to put together in his mind what he was seeing. And yet, his muddled mind would not believe it, and so he just stared dumbly. Then he could hear the clanking, canteen and bayonet, the tinkling of dog tags, P-38, tin cup. All the gear made a sort of rattling atavistic music, and the big rucksack shifted, boots shuffling with that inimitable slack-limbed indolence. No one else can walk like that, pose like that. It was unmistakable, for there was only one breed of human being the whole world over who could be so unstrung yet graceful. Movies have been made, novels written, about nothing more than that insouciant walk, that very carefree nonchalance with which he ambled toward them. That cool. He was a mere 50 yards off when my father's mind finally engaged, and at that moment he looked around at the guards, fully expecting to see them draw back the slides on their weapons and open fire. But what he saw instead was the young faces upturned, the slack expressions, not of fear, but the relief of thank God it's over. And as the lone figure advanced, they threw their weapons to the ground and put their hands in the air. The single GI sauntered straight and cool and casual toward them, and the guards stood stock still in their surrender, as the American Army scout crossed the compound yard toward my father, came right up to him, and cast his shadow over him so that my father could at last see his face. Big, crooked teeth and a leather grin, soft, indefinite-colored hair falling across his tanned face under his helmet, M1 rifle slung casually over his arm. Chewing gum. He grinned down, hardly glancing at the Germans. He took a smoke out of a pack of Luckies and offered the wounded flyer one. My father reached out and took it with his left, his good hand, and the GI flicked the Zippo with that inexpressible dexterity of the combat veteran and lit the two smokes, his own, then my father's, cupping his hands tenderly around my father's thin fingers. They both blew smoke out and stared at each other. "Hello, GI," the GI said. "You're a sight for sore eyes," my father said. "You look like you could use a bite." "Sure could." He was shaking all over, beset by a fever of unknown origin. The GI dropped his pack, dug around in it, and came up with cheese and a chunk of coarse bread. He tore off some bread, handed it to the starving flyer, and flicked out his gravity knife like a switchblade to cut a thick slice of cheese. My father fell to eating it like a dog, gnawing furiously, groaning out loud because he couldn't help himself, glancing up from bite to bite as if someone might snatch it from him. He noticed how sad the GI's grin was, and in it he saw how bad he must look, a ghost of himself, this flyer in a threadbare uniform, torn and bloodstained. He had been taken prisoner, weighing 170 pounds, and went home at 119. Families, too, develop their own survival rituals, their codes of integrity, ideas of what it means to be worthy. When I was growing up, my mother would make a special dinner every January 23rd to celebrate the day my father was shot down. And each year I'd hear a little bit more of his improbable story. I'd sometimes hear my father wake up screaming at night, too. And although I knew the stories were true, I'm not sure I could ever quite square the image I had of that boy falling out of the sky with the man he would become. The proof was always before me. His right arm, the one that was fixed with a stainless steel pin, moved only a few degrees at the elbow. When he dove off the diving board into the swimming pool, I could see how crooked it was. Amazing that he could walk, let alone dive. And when I was very little and came up only to his knees, I saw the horrible scars running the length of his shins. His feet were so deformed from the impact that they caused one of my brothers, Philip, to burst into tears as a toddler. My father had to have special shoes made just to walk without pain. The lesson, which it took me many decades to learn, was that he was here among us because he was cool. He was cool now, and had been cool at the moment of his death, saying nothing more than had to be said. This is it, and bail out, bail out, bail out, as prescribed on the checklist before him, as prescribed by the pilot's unspoken stoic code of conduct. He received the Distinguished Flying Cross not for that last flight, but for an earlier time when he was shot down and saved his crew through cool and skill and naked nerve. With two engines out, his radios gone, his plane's wings and tail shot to pieces, leaking fuel at a prodigious rate, he was inexorably descending through an overcast, recognizing that he'd have to order his crew to bail out, probably into the icy English Channel. They had no idea where they were when he spied a rocket punching through the overcast and turned toward the pink glow. His wheels barked onto the asphalt runway somewhere in Belgium, just in time for everything on his airplane to quit. His happy crew partied there until dawn, when the sound of wooden clogs stirred them to head for bed as the local people went to work. I have a photograph of him with three members of his crew, taken at the base in Nuthampstead before a flight in 1944. Charles Kahuri, who at that time was pilot to my father's co-pilot, stands on his right. To his left are Jack Layden and Jack Kutchback, both of whom flew the last mission. Those three men are neat and severe in their regulation uniforms, their hats on straight, their postures military. They look, well, nervous, if not afraid, even as they try to smile. My father, by contrast, is not only out of uniform, he has no shirt on. He wears Ray-Ban aviators, his hat cocked at a rakish angle, one foot swung out before him as if he's about to do a little dance step. He's grinning like the devil that I'm told he was. I always looked at that photo and thought, what in hell was he thinking? Many years later, I looked at it again and realized that the other three were dead, and he was alive. He hadn't let his injuries stop him, either. Sunday morning, early, he'd suddenly appear in the kitchen with a top hat and cane, doing a soft shoe and singing, "Gimme that old soft shoe," making drumming sounds and whistling the backup band arrangement. We'd squeal and clap, and then he'd twirl the cane around his finger like Diamond Jim, the riverboat gambler. He'd throw down the cane, grab up three eggs from among the dozen my mother was about to cook for breakfast, and he'd begin juggling, even as she protested that if he broke them, he'd have to go out and get some more, and she wasn't about to clean this floor again either. Break them? Unthinkable. Just to prove it, he'd juggle them behind his back. I had no doubt that he had been granted all of those abilities in one fell swoop by flying an airplane and being shot down. He had gone out to meet something terrible, and he had mastered it, and had come back to be treated like a king by all those around him, to sit and smoke and to be suave, smart, and handsome. The same innate focus and attention that kept him from dropping the eggs, that same ability to be an elite performer, had also allowed him to read the Journal of Cell Biology while five and then six and then seven suns raged around him, wreaking havoc. That couldn't be any harder than reading an emergency checklist inverted at 27,000 feet with your left wing shot off while you were spinning hard enough to suck your eyeballs out. I knew that there was little hope that I would ever have such righteous stuff. Certainly, he was never going to explain it to me. Aviators didn't chat like that. But the whole thing was irresistible. I was a child, but before I could even put a name on it, I was determined to steal my share. So it was that I ended up riding dirt bikes at 125 miles an hour on a dry lake bed in the Mexican desert in a whiteout dust storm. So it was that I wound up on a knife-edge cliff in a blizzard with no tent in the middle of the night on the highest point east of the Rockies. So it was that I found myself on a naked heap of chert somewhere above the Arctic Circle, clutching an automatic shotgun jammed with 9 rounds of alternating double-aught buck and deer slugs, awaiting the approach of a grizzly bear who'd caught the scent of our fresh caribou meat. So it was that I wound up flying upside down, 10 feet off the ground, going 150 miles an hour through an obstacle course in the Santa Susana Mountains in California. Then I'd write about it as best I could and give it to my father. Every ex-combat pilot has what they call an I Love Me room. In my father's den are his wings and memorabilia and the photos of him and his dead crew from the bad old Army Air Corps days. Across from that wall of glory, on a bookshelf, he keeps all the things I've written. My daughters tell me that I have the job every 13-year-old boy wants. My ex-wives tell me that I never grew up. Once he was shot down, my father's survival was not a matter of crawling up a mountain or catching fish in the Atlantic, as it was for Joe Simpson or Steve Callahan. But I have to think that his whole life had led him to that one point in an unconscious sequence of circumstances, judgments, and acts, which combined in the thrall of the forces that Clausewitz called friction and chance, the bipolar pull that circumscribes and defines the universe. The road that leads a Japanese tourist to drive beneath a falling 30-ton rock in Glacier National Park stretches back to the first divisions of a zygote, even as it begins scrawling out the definition of itself in lines of sugar-coated DNA. That doesn't mean that everything is fated. Indeed, just the opposite. It means the systems we live with are unpredictable and therefore have profound and unexpected results. But there are patterns in there, too. The same boy who rode his bicycle off a garage roof to see what would happen, who joined the cavalry in high school to feel the heat of the horse and the kick of the gun, had at last achieved what Leshak calls an almost mystical plane of awareness in learning to lean on the wind, accept the speed and noise and smoke, and to aim carefully and shoot straight, while both calming and thrilling to the complex ballet of which he was the silent center, the jockey to the horse. To fly, then, he had to do the same again in the smell of oil, in the heat and smoke, and then once more teach his spirit to fly straight and level and calmly terrified while explosions rocked his ship and razor-sharp, red-hot fragments of supersonic flak penetrated the thin aluminum skin of his aircraft, punching smoky fingers of light into the darkness within. And when one of those fingers pointed out a man, it would mean to select him for sacrifice. The sweet, sharp, continuous anguish of such learning had allowed him to will himself alive in the impossible dream of air. He worked out his own salvation. Survival is a continuous spiritual and physical act that spans a lifetime. Riding his bicycle off the roof and all the rich spinning of a whirlwind childhood taught my father how to fall. Saving his crewmen in Holland made him worthy to lose them over Neuss. With good-hearted determination, he not only rebuilt his own life, he rebuilt his crew, siring 8 sons. Sadly, the first died in infancy. But with my father as captain, our family made 9, which was the very number of men he had lost. First Lieutenant Federico Gonzalez was liberated from the Gerresheim camp on April 17, 1945. It was almost exactly 34 years later that I was writing for Playboy magazine, doing research on airline crashes and studying the flaws of one particularly notorious airplane, the McDonnell Douglas DC-10, a popular jumbo jet that had suffered more catastrophic in-flight failures than any other modern jetliner. As a contributing editor for the magazine, I was planning to join my colleagues on a trip to the American Booksellers Association convention in L.A. Shell Wax, our managing editor, was going. His wife, Judy, was going with him to promote her first book, which had just been published. Our fiction editor, Vicky Chen Hader, was going, as well as our foreign rights editor, Mary Sheridan. I was planning to join them on American Flight 191 to Los Angeles on the afternoon of May 25, 1979. But when I found out the airplane was a DC-10, I told Shell I'd thought better of it. He laughed and said I'd been reading too much. He was right, I had. Although I'd been flying in and out of crowded airspace in a small Piper aircraft for several years by then, the idea of getting on a DC-10 terrified me. That morning I sat in Shell's office on the 10th floor of the old Palmolive building, where Playboy had its headquarters. I was talking to Judy, who was a good friend. She signed a copy of her book for me. I said goodbye to Vicky, who had a one-year-old son. She and I often rode the bus to work together. I stopped in to see Mary, too, and wish her a good trip. I watched Shell and Judy go out to the Art Deco elevators walking arm in arm. I remember thinking how cool it was that they were still so in love, whispering and laughing like teenagers as they waited for the elevator. The flight lasted 31 seconds and crashed in an open field, just missing a fuel tank farm and a trailer park. The plane rolled nearly inverted before it hit the ground. Everyone was killed. 273 people, making it the worst aviation disaster in American history, even now, nearly a quarter century later. I lived only 20 minutes from the crash site and was there to report on it just after the fire was put out. Vicky, beautiful Vicky with her straight black Chinese hair, had to be identified by a bit of dental work. The event launched me into an even more intense period of flying and writing about aviation. But I was always haunted by how close I'd come to making my life exactly match my father's. I had always followed him, followed his example, tried to be like him. I thought of myself as the hero's apprentice. But later on, I began to see that I had it all wrong. He was no hero. He was a survivor. And somehow, I had worked out my own salvation, my survival, in a long series of acts, conditions, and judgments, leading up to the single word I spoke to Shell when he found me sitting on his raw silk couch with his wife and asked me if I didn't really want to come with them to L.A. that afternoon. My answer was, no. I had come to be a survivor, too, and not even the old man was the old man anymore. All of the acts, conditions, and judgments of a lifetime had put my father on a vector toward a spot in space and time where an 88-millimeter shell happened to be rising toward 27,000 feet above mean sea level on January 23, 1945. People have long accepted, at an unconscious level, the essence of theories such as chaos and complexity. Many stories have been written about what would happen if you could travel back in time and change just one thing, no matter how trivial. The doggerel verse that begins, "For lack of a nail, a shoe was lost. For lack of a shoe, a horse was lost," captures the idea. If Colonel Hunter had elected to fly left seat instead of right that day, I would not have been born, and you would not be reading this book. If I had been assigned to another story in 1973 instead of airline safety, I wouldn't have known about the DC-10 and would have gotten on that plane with Shell and Judy, and you would not be reading this book. But survival in the moment, or over hours or days or months, whether that survival comes about by chance or effort or an inexplicable combination, must be followed once more by the same struggle that led to that point. As Solon pointed out to Croesus, a life cannot be judged until it is complete. My own survival in not going with Shell and Judy, Vicky and Mary, and in all sorts of other situations, is something I'm still working out. If my father's fall planted the seeds of this book, then the crash of American Flight 191 fertilized them and made them grow. In a world governed by an ineluctable order, which pushes through Newtonian physics, Einsteinian relativity, thermodynamics, and quantum theory with all the certainty of gravity or any other encroaching natural law, nothing can truly be said to happen by chance, which is just a word we invented to explain the troublesome boundary between order and chaos. Fate, then, turns out to be the struggle, the tension between the natural law that dictates that everything should proceed toward disorder, entropy, and the natural law that dictates that everything should be self-organizing, complexity theory. If those are, indeed, the two overarching natural laws, then everything becomes clear, and we go forward into the past to find the Chinese concept of yin and yang. Certainly my father's survival did not end with his falling from the sky. I watched it take shape, even as it shaped me and my world. It began there, a man with broken legs and broken arms and broken feet and ribs, his nose stuck back on almost as an afterthought by a boy who happened by as he was weeping. Then he was packaged and shipped home. He told me that the most fearsome flight he'd ever had was not when his wing was shot off. It was the flight home, when they encountered a thunderstorm, and he sat watching the wings make wild excursions up and down, emptying the ashtrays on that old DC-3. He picked himself up and strove endlessly to grasp the world in which he found himself. I saw him rise from the grave and earn a Ph.D., find a job at a prestigious medical school, publish scientific papers, send platoons of new doctors out the door to heal, and in his spare time learn to become an excellent potter, to paint and draw and sing and play piano, carve sculptures out of wood, build model planes, tinker together our first stereo set, and drive his noisy family all over the continent in a 1956 Volkswagen bus looking for adventure. I saw him constantly and hungrily grappling with his world, trying everything, sampling everything, tasting the world, to understand, to feed his insatiable curiosity, even as he sat in darkness and peered through an electron microscope at the inner secrets of a cell. We spent one whole summer carving boomerangs out of various kinds of wood and studying the aerodynamics to explain why they returned instead of doing what Newton said they'd do, keep going. He was the only man I knew who'd read Finnegan's Wake from cover to cover. He reminded me of the great Santini, who told his son, "Eat life, or life will eat you." In his Zen fashion, my father would say, when I did something inexplicably wild, "Okay, but if you break your leg, don't come running to me." I saw that catastrophe had not broken him. He was the student who learned how to duck and therefore no longer needed swordsmanship. Adversity annealed him. It gave him endless energy. He taught me the first rule of survival: to believe that anything is possible. Appendix: The Rules of Adventure. At this point, you may be looking back over this book and thinking, that's all well and good, but what do I do now? How do I avoid getting into a survival situation? And if something should happen, how do I get out again? This book is not meant to tell people what to do, but rather to be a search for a deeper understanding that will allow them to know what to do when the time comes. And it always comes, in some form, for all of us. Nevertheless, there is some advice that can help in any survival situation, whether it's emotional survival, financial survival, or survival after breaking your leg at 19,000 feet on a Peruvian mountain. The concepts can be applied to any stressful situation, not just ones in which your life is threatened. These concepts, like this entire book, are not necessarily meant for the elite mountaineer, the fighter pilot, or the Olympic kayaker who face death on their own terms. They are meant for the rest of us who just want to get through life's rough spots and go out now and then to see the beauty or to get a little adrenaline fix. One piece of advice is to take the training that's available. Although most survival schools may not teach the mysteries of survival or accident theory, they have a lot to offer, and I recommend them, even to people who aren't planning to go into the wilderness. Once I was at Massacre Lake in northwestern Nevada, and a Bureau of Land Management geologist told me about a young couple from California with a new baby. They were traveling east and made the mistake of driving up a back road and into a blizzard in the mountains. They were stranded in a cave for several days until the man was able to walk out and get help. They weren't planning to go into the wilderness, but when the thin reed of technology on which they were leaning so heavily failed them, that's where they found themselves. Whatever else they did right or wrong, they would have done better if they'd been to a couple of survival schools first. At least they would have known to carry fire-making materials. I believe everyone should learn about basic survival skills and the survivor's frame of mind, because they come in handy when the trappings of civilization, or even the financial or emotional support that we take for granted, drop away for whatever reason. Instructors at survival schools are finding that more and more business people are taking their courses, not because they want to survive in the wilderness, but for the other qualities that grow out of knowing how. Here are a few suggestions, first for staying out of trouble, then for dealing with it when it comes. Perceive, believe, then act. Avoiding accidents, avoiding survival situations, is all about being smart. Horace Barlow, a neurobiologist, says that intelligence is a matter of guessing well. Guessing well involves a natural tendency people have, to predict. Training is an attempt to make predictions more accurate in a given environment. But as the environment changes, and it always does, what you need is versatility, the ability to perceive what's really happening and to adapt to it. So the training and prediction may not always be your best friend. There is a Korean martial art called Kum Do, which involves very sharp swords and, at least originally, an eventual fight to the death. It is related to Japanese kendo. Those who practice it today use bamboo sticks, but some of the moves that have survived the centuries were developed to shake blood off the blade so that it wouldn't coagulate and dull the edge. Kum Do teaches students to avoid the four poisons of the mind: fear, confusion, hesitation, and surprise. I had to think about that last one for a while, as the others seemed self-evident to me. But I recognized that our constant tendency to anticipate and predict may sometimes put us at a disadvantage. In Kum Do, the student must not anticipate his opponent's moves or allow his natural instinct for prediction to run free, for that could lead to surprise, which could lead to momentary confusion and then sudden death. Instead, he must watch, clear and calm, and then act decisively at the correct moment. Since a single blow can be lethal, can be, in fact, the only blow dealt in the fight, Kum Do teaches focus, precise bodily control, courtesy, humility, and confidence. Those are similar to the qualities you need when you engage the forces of nature. Some instructors at survival schools use the acronym STOP, S-T-O-P. Stop, think, observe, plan. It ought to be stop, observe, think, plan, and act, but that wouldn't make such a cute acronym. Those instructors intend to teach you how to react during a survival situation, but the same skills can help you to avoid one. It's important to have a plan and a backup plan or a bailout plan. What if sessions can help to develop backup plans and should precede any hazardous activity. But you must hold on to the plan with a gentle grip and be willing to let it go. Rigid people are dangerous people. If you plan all your moves beforehand in Kune Do, you will be cut in half by your opponent's sword. Survival is adaptation, and adaptation is change, but it is change based on a true reading of the environment. Sometimes sticking to the plan is best, and improvising causes trouble. When I went into Glacier National Park, if I had simply stuck to the plan to walk the nature trail instead of getting sucked into a long hike by the beauty, I would have stayed out of trouble. And if I had turned around each time I reached a fork in the path and carefully observed what the correct trail looked like, I would not have gotten lost. Those who avoid accidents are those who see the world clearly, see it changing, and change their behavior accordingly. This won't save everyone from everything, nothing will, but it will help a great deal in most situations. As Mark Morey, my survival instructor from Vermont, told me, "We come from cities and learn to expect things to stay the same, but they don't, and it kills us, quickly or slowly." Avoid impulsive behavior. Don't hurry. Catecholamines are a double-edged sword. They provide power when you need that burst of energy. I know a man who lifted a full-size Chrysler four-door sedan off his daughter's leg after a car accident. But they can also make you so excited that you do the wrong thing. Don't be the snowmobiler or skier who dashes out onto an avalanche slope just because it's a wonderful day and the beauty is on duty. John Bouchard is an elite mountaineer with more than 30 years of experience. He told me, "On my last expedition in Pakistan, it was obvious that conditions weren't right. We tried the climb and our ropes were cut by stonefall. I was shaken up and I had a bad feeling. I didn't want to go. But my partner insisted, so we tried another route. And once I started, it was like a dog after a bitch in heat. I forgot my resolve to be careful. I just said, 'Screw it, let's go for it.' We didn't even take any bivy gear. The strange thing is, I know I'd do it again." Here he laughed, still unable to explain to himself how someone with so much knowledge and experience could have done something so foolhardy. "Luckily, in the last 400 feet, we didn't have the right gear. There was no way of protecting the climb, so we had to turn around at 20,000 feet. We didn't have to spend the night out there." Even elite performers struggle to find emotional balance and control. They too have to correct their courses as they go. They make big mistakes or small ones with big consequences. What separates the living from the dead is an ability to see the error and adapt, a determination to get back on the path. Even the most unforgiving environments allow a few sins if you adjust your behavior and take correct action in a timely fashion. Know your stuff. Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and general, wrote, "Of each particular thing ask, what is it in itself, in its own construction?" A deep knowledge of the world around you may save your life. People who don't understand the nature of water, for example, may tie a rope around themselves, as they do too frequently before entering swift water, to save someone, to retrieve something, to cross to the other bank. And then they die because the system created by water and rope pulls them under and holds them there. The climbers on Mount Hood did not understand the system they were using, nor the forces they could encounter. Know the system and keep in mind that the forces may be so large or fast that they're difficult to imagine. Get the information. When I met Mike Crowder on Lydgate Beach on Kauai, I was dangerously ignorant. Mine was not an emotional problem. I wasn't impulsively going to leap into the surf there. I just wanted to go swimming and didn't have the information. There are lots of places like that. Mount Hood, Mount Washington, Lamb's Slide, Glacier National Park, the Potomac River, and most ski areas. Those are what I call danger or hazard zones. The same accidents happen over and over, year after year. It's a simple thing to know, but so many people plunge in without inquiring. Park rangers, lifeguards, and local authorities are happy to tell you if you only ask. Commune with the dead. If you could collect the dead around you and sit by the campfire and listen to their tales, you might find yourself in the best survival school of all. Since you can't, read the accident reports in your chosen field of recreation. Accidents in North American Mountaineering, the National Speleological Society's newsletter, River Safety Report, and numerous other publications